Shabbat Shalom.
Shalom.
Can you hear me in the back? Sort of? Okay. We're at Shabbat Bamidbar. And if you look in your Eitz Chaim, you'll find the beginning of the Parsha on page 769. Bamidbar is a Parsha that begins with a census. It goes on to the arrangement of the camp after giving you a paragraph about the number of people in each tribe. People with an asterisk, bear that in mind. The arrangement of the camp, and then the duties of the various parts of the Levite tribe. Does not sound like the most exciting parsha ever. And in fact, I'd like you, if you're in your bar, in your book, to open to page 772. Who can tell me what is unusual about page 772 in the Eitz Chaim? No footnotes, no commentary, nothing, just stomp the text. Oh my goodness. When the editors of the Eitz Chaim come up with nothing to say about a whole page of the Torah, what in the world am I supposed to say? Well, what a moment. Here we are, it's Shabbat, and we always read Bamidbar on the Shabbat right before Shavuot, just before we celebrate receiving the Torah. So Bamidbar in the desert or the wilderness. Midbar doesn't really mean desert in the sense of a place that gets no water. It certainly doesn't feel like a desert here in Portland, Oregon, where the arrival of the Rose Festival is pretty much guaranteed to coincide with rain. This year, maybe just yesterday, more rain than we've seen in weeks. But Bamidbar is really about the Midbar, the wilderness, the area, an area of land that belongs to no one, an area of land that is without an owner. And if you read the commentary on the first few verses of this parsha, the traditional commentary calls attention to how we have to be in the Midbar, the ownerless land, the open land, to be able to receive the Torah. And I commend that commentary to you. What I want to focus on is a slightly different sense of being Bamidbar. This parsha locates us right at the beginning in time and space. It begins with a clarification of the moment in time when its words were first conveyed, and then with a very specific clarification and naming of the space we inhabited and where Moses received these words. So I want to say that as we perhaps struggle to lift ourselves from our daily struggles, not just into the rest and comfort of Shabbat, which comes every week, but the celebration of Shavuot, which comes only once a year, I think this parsha comes to remind us of how to focus on arranging our lives in time and space and fulfilling our tasks so that we can protect what is truly holy in our lives, identify what is truly holy in our lives, and act on the realization that sometimes we need to count and name every person and thing around us, no matter how tedious it might seem, in order to realize what truly counts. What's amazing to me and to the commentators I read on this parsha is the subtlety and the power of how this parsha conveys these supportive messages. Recognize what is holy, protect the holy, and act in holy ways. That's the key, says this parsha, to transforming wasteland into the home of a holy people, moving from Midbar to Midaber, from the salt flats that produce nothing to effective speech that brings order out of apparent chaos. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the way that the Parsha structures time and space and society, our lives, starting with time. Time, when we stop and think about it, is a pretty challenging concept. It takes an enormous amount of social organization to locate us in time. We don't normally think about that, but this week, as I was thinking about this parsha, I heard on OPB that the Oregon legislature just introduced a bill that would allow us to live on daylight savings time all year round. It would abolish those awful transitions where we move 1 hour forward and 1 hour back to make up for it, and we never know what time it is for the next week, and the number of accidents go up for the week, and it's just terrible for a week in the spring and the fall. Instead, we would just be on the same time all year round. But in order to pass that change in time, this bill demands that Washington and California would also pass the same bill. So look at how many millions of people have to agree in order for our time to be something that we actually recognize and understand. So time doesn't just happen, it's a social construction, and it makes a difference in how we think about what is important. We make up time, essentially. We make up how we understand time in order to clarify what matters to us, when it matters to us, and how it matters to us. So, if you look at the first verse of the Parsha, look how it identifies the moment. On the first day of the second month, in the second year following the Exodus from the land of Egypt. As the Torah tells us in an earlier Parsha, we're going to count time from the month in which we became a free people, people able to shape our own time so that time frames what we hold most dear. And in opposition to time, we have the concept of eternity. I think embedded in this Parsha is a reference also to eternity and to the way that eternity and that kind of limitless time gives us access to holiness. So that very first sentence introduces the moment in time, but it also names the space in which Moshe and Bnei Yisrael found themselves. They were not just Bamidbar. They were not just in the wilderness. They were in Bamidbar Sinai. And a Hasidic commentator who knows far more than I do pointed out that this Parsha is the only Parsha in the Torah where we actually have a reference not just to Sinai, but to the wilderness of Sinai, Midbar Sinai. So what does that mean, Midbar Sinai? We are in a space defined by Sinai, the location of the giving of the Torah, but we're in Midbar Sinai. We're not on or even at the foot of Sinai. We are in the wilderness that stretches out around Sinai. In other words, we're in real life. We know there's something really important, really valuable, really holy about it, but that's not quite where we feel ourselves living. Instead, we're in Bamidbar Sinai. I would go so far as to say that Bamidbar Sinai is a way of naming a place where we know that Sinai and the revelation that happened there that we'll be celebrating later this weekend exist, but sometimes it's impossible to even catch sight of that central reality of life around which we orient ourselves. Really, aren't there days when you forget that Mount Hood is even there, when you haven't seen it for a week or 2 weeks or months? And aren't there times when you feel like you're wandering in a wilderness? I know what I'm supposed to be doing is supposed to make sense, but why exactly am I pushing myself to get through my whole to-do list? That is Midbar Sinai. So how does this Parsha come to address that sense of bewilderment and loss of the central focus of the holiness of our lives? Well, have you read the Parsha? At first, it doesn't seem very promising. It doesn't give us a nice, lively story with characters we can relate to who overcome challenges and move on with a renewed sense of purpose. That would be satisfying, wouldn't it? That's the story of our journey to Mount Sinai, the receiving of the Torah, the golden calf, and the receiving of the second set of tablets, the ones that Moses, a real human being, made for other real human beings. We'll connect to that story during Shavuot. Today, that Parsha, this Parsha, gives us guidance that is, on the one hand, more banal and mundane, and in some ways, I think, more enduring. This Parsha comes to remind us that an appropriate response to finding ourselves Bamidbar Sinai is to count ourselves, name ourselves, and create order in order to facilitate the actions that are most important. Bamidbar Sinai, in the wilderness of Sinai, Hashem told Moses to take a census, literally to lift up the heads, count and list the names of the entire Israelite community. So on the one hand, taking a census seems like a really boring and perhaps beside the point response to a challenging situation. But let's think about our own moment in time. I think we can all agree that the current struggles over how to take the census actually do signal how crucial it is that we get the counting right. We need all the names, all the numbers, all the people in order to continue in our holy path of self-determination, democracy, our commitment to every person counts, one person, one vote. Just as Hashem directs Moses to get someone from every tribe to assist him in making the proper count, so we too need to make sure that every kind of diverse identity is accurately present, not just in taking the census, but in shaping the census. The Parsha lists the name of every tribe. We know all the names of the heads of the tribes: Reuven, Simon, Shimon, Yehuda, Issachar, Zvulun, Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, Binyamin, Dan, Asher, Gad, Naphtali. But the Parsha also gives us the name of the representatives from those tribes. Much less familiar, I think. We may all remember Nachshon ben Aminadav, the representative of Judah, who helped Moshe take the census because of those wonderful stories we tell at Passover about how Nachshon ben Aminadav actually was the first one to jump into the Reed Sea, even before it parted, showing that we have to take that first step into freedom before the path opens up before us. But I bet there aren't very many of us who remember Achira ben Enan, the son of Naphtali, from one year to the next. But he played an important role in this census, in this counting. So by naming those lesser known individuals, the Parsha subtly reminds us that there are many aspects of holiness that we need to be reminded of over and over again, aspects of holiness that we need to awaken and motivate in order even to begin to organize our lives around the holiness we want to remember and to bring into fruitfulness in our own lives. Okay, if you've read the Parsha, you're probably thinking, well, Gail, there are a couple of problems with seeing this Parsha as offering us much guidance for dealing effectively with the challenges of losing sight of holiness. Most of the women reading this Parsha today, and probably a lot of the men, are going to be highly aware that this is not really a census of all of the Israelites, right? Moses and his minions only count the men, and they only count the men of fighting age. So what's with that as a way of counting the census? Are we supposed to learn from that only some people count? No, I think it's true that the Parsha tells us how to organize a hierarchical, patriarchal society. Pick a man from each male-defined group to count all the men who are capable of fighting, of defending Israel. We are rightly uncomfortable with the patriarchal, hierarchical, military focus of the narrative. And here's where I think it's important to take some direction from Hasidic and feminist readings of this text. So for the Hasidic reading, or a Hasidic reading, I turn to the Sfat Emet. In discussing the census in this parsha, he says, "The Torah that lies before us is only the garb or clothing of the Torah. It is by means of study and commentary that we can arouse the force that lies within it. That is the real power of Israel, to awaken the root of Torah. Through our struggle to understand and interpret, the inner Torah spreads through the Torah garb. Outer and inner become one." So that sense of moving in and out, of moving through layers, is one that I would like to bring to my thinking about this parsha. So remember the structure. Moses is told to take a census. We get the census. Then we get the arrangement of the Israelite camp. And finally, we get the service of the Levites at the center of the camp around the tent of meeting, where Moses has been addressed by Hashem at the beginning of the parsha. In other words, the parsha moves from names and numbers to a kind of geometry of the holy, as one feminist commentator called it, the setup of the encampment, and the service of the Levites in the tent of meeting. And I said that's how the parsha is shaped. That's also how the Torah is shaped. We have just come out of the central book of the Torah, in which we learned all about holiness and the temple, the tabernacle and the temple. And now we're moving outward to the frame. We move inward toward holiness and out of holiness to express that, and back inward to holiness and outward to express it. We learn from the structure of this parsha that counting alone is probably the least important thing to do, but it's necessary. It gets us to the service to the unnamed presence that we can encounter in the tent of meeting, which is the most important, the source of holiness in our lives. Naming is more important than counting. We have to recognize the individuality of each member of B'nai Yisrael, the sacredness of each person, the sacredness of each task and each moment. And then there's the encampment. Here we have an image of how we have to protect what is holy. We have to set up all of our tasks and reminders and names and responsibilities around what is holy in order to be able to protect it. We may not be able to name what is holy. We may not be able to get to that moment of eternity that is the source of the holy, but we can build structures to protect it. And to bring this back to our own time, I would say that in order to protect what is holy, to recognize what is holy, to protect what is holy, and to act in ways that are holy, we need to concentrate on how we build those structures. Unlike the patriarchal military structure of the camp, what we're looking at in our democratic American society is building a structure that allows us all, whatever our gender, ability, race, age, class, whether we're immigrant or refugee, whoever we are, however we name ourselves, We all have to be able to participate in the holy work of building a society. Those categories that I just named name categories of individuals who are marginalized. We have to remember that every one of those individuals has to count, not only in the census, but in creating structures that protect, recognize, and act on the holiness that we strive to bring into full fruition in the world. And I would name that holiness the sacredness of each human being made B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God. Shabbat Shalom.